Learning pretty well. Now we get to the good stuff. And the woman on the ground wasn't Ben's mother anymore. Time to go, Ben told Terry. The woman was like him, like Ben, a victim. And he could take the easy route, like his mother had, as he had been doing all this time, or he could stop it. Terry gave him an irritated look. Bugger off yourself, then. He bent down and patted her tattoo. This one's mine. And Ben did what he told himself he was going to do when he bought the knife in the first place. He cut Terry's throat, then ripped off his head. He left the body in the poor woman's apartment. He'd cleaned up and headed over to turn himself in to the Alpha for punishment, only to find that there had been a change in leadership. The wolf who ruled the rest of London had decided to take over the rival pack. Ben was too freaked from killing Terry to recognize that the pack Bonds had been trying to tell him the old Alpha was dead. The new Alpha didn't kill Ben, but the police were looking for Terry's accomplice, so he'd exiled Ben to the good old U.S. of A., and Ben had been given to Adam to see if there was anything worth saving inside Ben's skin. Luckily for him, Adam seemed to view him as a challenge. And right now, he needed to pull his reformed head out of his arse because he'd just left a little helpless lamb out for a man who thought himself the big bad wolf. If she'd been Mercy, he wouldn't be worried. Duffy would be lucky if he could walk tomorrow. But if she'd been Mercy, Duffy would never have chosen her as a target. Mel kept her back against the door as if that might help. No, she said, I won't. But she knew that she would, and so did Duffy. It was in the confidence of his voice and body. For Chris, she would do anything. The doorknob turned, and the door rather gently pushed her to the side, and Ben the Grouch, that's what the office workers called him, came in. She stared at him in shock. Blackmailed Duffy, said Ben, towing off his snow-covered shoes and stowing them next to hers, as if he'd done it 100 times. That's pretty low, even for you. There was something funny with his voice. It was deeper and less crisp than usual, almost slurry, and she wondered if he'd had too much to drink. His body language was a little off, too. He kept his gaze slightly averted, never looking directly at Duffy or her. Duffy set the wine down on the table abruptly, losing the smile. There was a flash of rage before it was replaced by sternness. Did he practice his expressions in front of a mirror?
I'm sorry that it had to go down this way, Mel, he said so sincerely she almost could have believed that they'd been having a business discussion instead of a proposition.
Duffy turned to Ben, his face serious.
I don't know how much you overheard, but it's not what you think. Someone has been leaking information, and I just narrowed it down to Melinda. I was trying to see how far it had gotten by letting her believe I would cover for her, but you put the kibosh on that.
She'd never seen anyone lie so smoothly. People would believe him. He was influential, and he had money.
Are you really selling secrets, Mel?
Ben sounded amused, in the mocking sort of way he had.
Shame, shame. So where is all the money going?
He glanced around, making a big production of the tiny living room and kitchen that comprised half of her apartment. He stretched his neck from one side to the other as if it were stiff, and when he was done, he focused on Duffy.
Your eyes...
Duffy momentarily lost his usual confidence and looked shaken.
What big teeth you have, dear, said Ben.
At least that's what she thought he said, though it didn't make any sense. Duffy took a gulp of his wine, regrouped quickly from whatever had bothered him. He said,
All the more reason that getting on my bad side would be a terrible idea, if you want to keep your job, Shaw. Walk away, and I'll forget what I've seen.
Ben laughed, and the sound made her take a step away from him. It was not a good laugh.
You're making a mistake.
Duffy stood up. He was a big man, taller and heavier built than Ben. He worked out. He told her that, along with tales of his black belt when he had been trying to impress her.
No, said Ben. I've made lots of mistakes. I know what that feels like. This is not a mistake. And as for what I am, whoop-de-freakin-do, it's not a crime. She's a traitor, Duffy said, and I can make your job very uncomfortable. Ben snorted. She's a secretary. She doesn't have access to anything. My doddering old mum in merry old England knows more about hacking than she does.
He smiled, and Mel found herself stepping away from that smile until her legs hit the bookcase under the TV. The smile hadn't been aimed at her, though.
Duffy stumbled as he backed up against the counter in the kitchen, which was as far as he could go. Ben followed him, crowding him by just standing in the kitchen. There was no amusement in his voice when he growled, "And if you've manufactured something that you think will implicate her, let me tell you that you aren't hacker enough to cover your tracks from me."
Then he stepped to the side and pointed to the front door.
"Leave, right now."
Duffy didn't even so much as glance at Mel as he bolted out the door. She closed the door and glanced over at Ben. He was bent over, hands on his thighs, as if he had just run a race.
"Ben," she said, "thank you."
She hugged herself.
"But this was a mistake. We're both going to be out of work."
She had no family and only her friends at work. With Duffy spinning stories, she'd have to stay away from them.
"Maybe in jail."
"I watched a man brutalize women once," he told her without looking up. "I was under orders, but finally put a stop to it anyway. Never again."
She blinked at him.
"Under orders? In the military?"
He laughed, coughed, and said, "In a manner of speaking, pack business."
Pack?
The word should mean something to her, she knew, but she was still worried about what she was going to do without a job. He lifted his head, and she saw what Duffy had. His eyes weren't human.
"You're a werewolf," she whispered.
She'd never seen a werewolf in person before, though she knew there were some in the Tri-Cities. She had seen a wolf at the zoo, though, and it had had the same hungry, golden eyes.
"Yes," he said. "And I didn't even need to appear on four paws before you got it."
"Sarcasm is the lowest form of wit," she said, hurt, though she thought that she ought to be more afraid. "A werewolf. That explains some things about Ben." He bent his head down again and huffed as if he was having trouble catching his breath. Or maybe he was laughing.
"You know it's bad when they start quoting Oscar."
"Oscar?"
He glanced at her.
"Oscar Wilde."
His face contorted, released, and then contorted again as his light English complexion darkened.
"F-f-f-f-freaking fire truck, that hurts."
He bent back down and made a noise that made her cringe. She wanted to help, but she didn't know how. She was out of work, possibly about to be arrested, and Ben was changing into a scary beast right in front of her. And that was something else he'd given up to try to help her. If he'd wanted people to know what he was, he'd have told them before this.
"I won't tell anyone," she said, "about your being a werewolf. At work, I mean. Not that I have a job anymore."
"Psst," he interrupted her nervous babble. "Won't matter whom you tell. Duffy will announce it to the world. Now shut up a moment, and let me get this out because I don't have much time. If you are fired, I can find you work while you sue for sexual harassment. I and the rest of the DBAs will be happy to testify. Duffy has squat on you."
He looked up again, and she wished he hadn't. His face was wrong.
"Unless you have been selling secrets."
"No," she said.
"Thought not. Whatever he has is made up, and he's not good enough with computers to make a convincing case. He can barely open his own flipping email."
He bent down again. His fingers whitened as he took a stronger grip on his calves.
"Full moon tomorrow, love, and apparently I'm not man enough to stave off the change. I'm about to go werewolf on you, so listen up. I have help coming. Should be here in about a half hour. You go into your bedroom and shut the door like a good girl, and don't come out for about 15 minutes.
He breathed hard and with obvious effort, but he didn't stop talking until his whole body tightened up and shook. When it stopped, he took a deep breath.
"Right. I won't hurt you, but watching someone change is pretty gross for you and painful for me, and we'll both be happier if you tuck yourself away until I'm done."
"Okay," she whispered,
but her feet were frozen to the floor, and she knew exactly how a deer felt, stuck out there in the middle of the road, with a truck bearing down on it, but too shocked by the bright lights to run. He looked up and snorted. His face was distorted by sharp teeth that looked too big for his mouth. She covered her own mouth with her hands.
"Now," he growled.
She did better than just shut the door. She crawled onto her bed and pulled the blankets up around her ears so she didn't have to hear the noises he was making. The TV made it sound so romantic to be a werewolf. It didn't sound romantic. It sounded scary, and it sounded like it hurt.
Ben stretched and glanced at the shreds of his pants. He'd managed to shed most of his clothes after Mel had rabbited into her bedroom, but the pants had stayed on and suffered the beast's wrath. He shook himself and looked around for a place to wait for Mercy, who'd promised to hurry to Mel's house as soon as he'd called, but she was all the way out in Finley, and it would take her a while to get here. He took a step, and his hip hit one of the kitchen chairs. He stepped back and bumped into the cabinets. The house was small, tiny even. There wasn't any place he could see in Mel's house big enough for him to sit down, except the love seat, and even it would be iffy. He hopped up, careful not to dig his claws into the faded floral print fabric. The arm made a nice chin rest. Mel's house was like her. Small, not too bright, but warm and uncluttered. Safe. His secretary. His. He snorted, and wondered what the other DBAs would say if they realized that he thought of them as his people. He wiggled a little to get more comfortable, while he waited for Mercy to pick him up. Mel sat among the DBAs who had tried their best to get front row. They hadn't succeeded, because the security team had made it to the auditorium ahead of everyone else. Lorna Winkler took the stage first, and all the men around Mel straightened in their chairs and brushed dandruff off their shoulders. Mel exchanged a rueful look with Amanda, one of the few women in the DBA division. Lorna might not be brilliant or even know much about computers, but she was able to get the IT department all aimed in the same direction when she needed to, if only because all the men in IT would do anything she asked of them, as long as she did it in her beautifully modulated voice. And the men outnumbered women in the IT department by better than 3-1. As Lorna spoke of how impressed she'd been with their performance last quarter, Mel imagined her practicing it in front of the mirror. There were bets about how often world peace would come up in the speech. The most in a previous speech had been 6, though Mel hadn't been there for that one. Rumor was that once she hadn't said those 2 words together, but no one believed it. Mel was glad her mother had never sent her out to be scarred from too many beauty pageants at too young an age. "I believe that we must, all of us, strive every day to become better people," Lorna said, smiling so that everyone could see her perfectly capped white teeth. "Small steps lead to great ones, like world peace and liberty for all. In that vein, I have to tell you that it pleases me to encourage you by presenting one of your own who has overcome a very bad habit. He has agreed to speak to us today about how he accomplished that and how you might improve yourselves. I give you Ben Shaw," she smiled, "IT's favorite werewolf." A polite applause arose and stopped. Ben got up and put an empty decanter of whiskey on the side of the podium.
"My speech," he said, reading awkwardly from a sheet of paper in front of him, "is about how I broke my fucking habit of drinking shitty whiskey."
By the time he'd finished, the audience was in stitches. He'd kept a serious demeanor the whole time, along with that awkward, serious voice that managed to counter the impression of intelligence Ben's British accent encouraged. The contrast between his tone and the words he was using made Mel want to clear the wax out of her ears because the combination was just so wrong and funny. Ken Lincoln, sitting next to Mel, said in awe,
"I don't think I've heard that many swear words in such a short period in my life, and I was in the army. And the best part is that I don't have to quit smoking."
"What exactly is a pony-shagging, bitch-faced ballbuster?" asked Amanda, sounding strangled as she wiped her eyes. Mel was watching Lorna Winkler's face as one of the upper management, a grin on his face, shook her hand. She was pretty good at lip-reading, but he was faced half away. She caught comedy routine and not boring, and, as Lorna smiled graciously, good idea. Ben smiled slyly at Mel, then joined Lorna and shook hands with Lorna's bosses. Hollow. There can't be a collection of Mercyverse stories without a Mercy story, right? I have always had vivid dreams. Those dreams are especially real when I am sick. Sometimes it takes me a while to figure out which part was the dream and which the reality. This story is born from a nightmare about an old friend who was being haunted by his murdered wife. It is also about Mercy making peace with the changes in her life, which have been sea changes over the past few books. There are a few spoilers for Night Broken in this story. The events in Hollow take place after the events in Night Broken. The Beginning, 13 years ago, All Hallows' Eve. Rick folded his father's suit and set it in a box that was going to charity. The whole room was packed into boxes. A double row of donation items, boxes for auction, and two boxes of items he decided to keep. The only thing left was his father's bag of personal effects. Then he could put his father's presents behind him. A year ago he'd have mourned, if for nothing but the lost opportunity for a change for the better. But he was a different man now, at 22, than the boy he'd been at 21. Losing both of his parents within months of each other would change anyone, especially since his mother had committed suicide, and 6 months later his father drove off a cliff. His death had been ruled an accident, but Rick was undecided. His father had been a very good driver. But it wasn't just his parents' deaths that had changed him. Finding his wife's dead body and then being charged with her murder had started the ball rolling. After he'd survived the trial with his freedom and sanity intact, or mostly intact, he'd become a man who could go through his father's things without feeling either rage or sorrow. He picked up the white plastic bag that held the contents of his father's pockets and whatever happened to be on his body when he'd arrived at the hospital, and spilled the contents out on the desk. His father's wedding ring. Why he wore one when he never had honored the vows it was supposed to represent, Rick had never been able to fathom. His wallet. A handful of change. Rick opened the wallet. Someone at the hospital or the morgue had emptied the cash. His father would never have been driving around without cash. The credit card seemed to be all there, though. He set those aside along with his father's driver's license to be shredded. There were two photos, battered and worn, in the wallet. Rick at 6 or 7 with a softball bat over one shoulder and a determined look on his face. And Rick's mother, one of the photos taken at their wedding. Rick looked like he was on his way to being an athlete, and his beautiful mother looked sweet and happy. Rick wondered why his father would keep those photos, the ones that lied so badly about the people in them. Rick had never, that he could remember, hit a softball and made it go anywhere but in the foul zone. And his mother, well, sweet and happy were not adjectives he'd have applied to her. Maybe his father had liked to pretend that his life was different than it really was. Rick understood that impulse, even if he'd always been more of the face-the-bad-stuff-head-on kind of guy. So Rick put both photos in the to-be-shredded pile and tossed the wallet in the charity box. There was something more in the bag, and Rick dumped it out. A thick silver chain with a blocky, carved jade pendant that looked both arty and masculine. It was a nice piece, but he didn't wear jewelry, and he didn't want a reminder of his father wrapped around his neck. He picked it up and held it up to the light, so he could judge if this was something that should go to auction, or if he should give it to charity. As he held it, he thought absently that it might have been an expensive piece. A deft hand had created the angles and the deliberately primitive lines of the pendant. Toward the center, there was a change in color from clear, translucent green to frost. The carving dipped just there, as if the someone had started to carve out the cloudy bit, but had reconsidered. He checked for a maker's mark, something he could use to determine value. He liked the way it felt in his hand, like the contrast between cold chain and warm pendant. For the first time since he'd begun cleaning out the room this morning, Rick felt something. He clenched the pendant in his fist and let himself feel the love he had for his family. Twisted and broken as they had been, he'd still loved them. The necklace felt like family. He snorted at his own fancy. "Don't anthropomorphize," he advised himself. "It's a piece of jewelry." But he put the chain around his neck anyway, and didn't feel as alone with the pendant warm in the hollow of his throat. Mercy, present day. I walked up to the remains of my garage with the paperwork the insurance adjuster had given me and the paperwork Adam's choice of contractor had given me. Spring was old, and summer just around the corner, and the garage where I'd spent the better part of the last 13 years looked beyond resurrection. Adam's friend, the contractor, was of the impression it would be much more economical to bulldoze the remains of the structure and start over, because the fixes that the insurance adjuster had approved payment for weren't adequate in the contractor's opinion. And in fact, the day after the insurance adjuster's report had come, which had been 3 days after the county had allowed us in to clear all of my inventory, half of the garage had collapsed. Apparently, when the volcano god tunneled under the building, he'd weakened some of the surrounding soil substructure, or something like that. I was just glad that no one had been hurt. We had the contractor set up a 10-foot-high chain-link fence around the whole place in an effort to keep neighborhood kids out while I healed up and made up my mind what to do with the garage. It was my life, the life I'd built for myself after I'd realized I didn't fit anywhere, so I'd have to make my own place. And I'd done it, found a place to belong. And when Z, the grumpy old Fay who owned it, had been forced to admit what he was and move to the Fay Reservation, I'd made it my own. And here it was, lying in wreckage at my feet. I knew that the right thing to do was to squeeze more money out of the insurance company, bulldoze the remnants, and sell the lot for what I could get. Any car built in the last decade needed plug-in parts changers, not mechanics. Most of the cars I fixed were older than I was, owned by people who could barely afford their 40-year-old cars. There wasn't enough money to be made in the business to justify dumping in more. Adam's contractor thought we'd need to throw in $50,000 or $60,000 more after the insurance money kicked in to rebuild because there were so many things that would have to be brought up to the current building code. Most years I was lucky if I cleared $15,000, and that only because of the cars we rebuilt for the collector's market, and because my right-hand man Tad worked for freakin' peanuts. I'd come here today to say goodbye when Adam wasn't here to see me do it. If I'd come here with him, he'd know how much this battered building mattered to me, and he'd rebuild it himself if he had to do it using nothing but the rubble lying around. It wasn't worth that. Wasn't worth a moment of Adam's worry. I'd given him enough pain the past year or so. He didn't know that I knew he woke up in the middle of the night and put his head against my chest to hear my heartbeat. Didn't know I knew he had nightmares that Coyote hadn't come in time to fix me. Being important to someone, to anyone, was something I'd hungered for most of my life. Adam was the lodestone of my life, and I didn't like it when I hurt him. An unfamiliar car pulled up beside me. I turned around to see a gold Chevy Tahoe that had seen better days. It bore a graceful stencil, Simon Landscaping and Lawn Care, complete with address, phone, and contractor license number. The driver's side window rolled down next to me, and a woman I'd never met before said, "Please tell me that you're Mercedes Thompson, who is now married with a different last name that no one can remember, because this is the third time I've driven past here in the vain hope that I'd run into you." She was human. I blinked at her, pulling on my professional self. I was at work, even if my garage was in rubble. "Yes?" "Yes?" she repeated with the same questioning inflection I'd given it. "Yes, I'm Mercedes," I told her with a smile. Professionalism allowed me to bottle up all the angst until I wasn't in the presence of a possible customer. I was very grateful to this stranger for allowing me that retreat. And it's Hauptmann. Her jaw dropped.
Hauptmann, the alpha werewolf of the tri-frickin' cities? That Hauptmann?
I nodded, and she banged her forehead into her steering wheel.
How could they have forgotten that? Her husband's a werewolf, she said. I almost called him, you know. Probably would have if I hadn't run into you here.
I cleared my throat, wondering how to pull her up without offending her. You needed to talk to me?
You probably think I'm a freaking idiot, she told the steering wheel. This is why I send out my assistant to talk to people.
I found myself smiling at the remnants of my garage. No worries, I told her. Life goes on. What was it Coyote had told me once? Change is neither good nor bad. It's just change. Frightening, but survivable. I'd survived a lot worse than the destruction of my garage, and I'd learned a lot along the way.
What can I help you with? I asked her.
She took a deep breath, glanced at me from under her bangs, and said,
I'm in love.
Then she looked horrified and surprised, and red swept up from her jaw to her cheeks.
I didn't mean to say that. He doesn't know.
She looked at me, this woman whose name I didn't have, with total urgency.
You can't tell him, okay? Not a word.
I cleared my throat. That's not going to be a problem unless I know who he is. Is it someone I know? She shook her head.
No.
Then,
I don't think so.
She looked at me.
Shoot me now. Shit. I practiced. I had this smooth speech thing.
Yeah, said a voice behind me. I think that you might ought to have used it because we don't got a foggy idea of what you need.
Zack's voice was kind, even if his words weren't particularly gracious.
Mercy, it looks to me like someone managed to slide under the fence between now and the last time we looked. I don't believe they managed to get anywhere dangerous.
Which meant he trailed their scent around, and they hadn't gone into the building or burrowed under the large and heavy metal plate we put over the outside opening into the tunnel.
Still, it would be good to get this place bulldozed before someone manages to kill themselves exploring.
Okay, I told him. I'll call Bill today and give him the thumbs up. Zack's hand came up and ruffled my hair. He was a new wolf to our pack, but once he'd gotten comfortable with us, he'd started touching everyone. I'd have thought it would bother me, bother some of the others more, but he was a submissive wolf. Those are pretty rare, and all the touching had turned out to be just what the pack needed to get comfortable with all the changes that had been coming their way, our way. I think we were what he needed, too. When he'd come to us a couple of months ago, he'd been, as Warren described it, jumpier than a jackrabbit on speed. Now that Zack had settled down, there was a happy cloud that followed him wherever he went, spread by his touch. Maybe that's why Adam had sent him with me today. I'd needed a happy cloud. I gave the woman a smile in hopes that would reassure her. Maybe we should start with introductions. I'm Mercy, and this is my friend Zack.
You are Lisa Simon, she said, sounding relieved that I had taken over the conversation. I am so glad I found you. I have a...
She stopped, held up a hand.
I've got this now. I have a yard care company centered in Yakima, but we service all the way from the Tri-Cities to Ellensburg, about 100-mile radius. We do everything from designing yards to maintenance, and I have two crews of 4 people each who work for me full-time. For the last 8 years, I've been maintaining the lawn for Richard Albright.
I blinked. The Richard Albright? Wealth, brilliance, eccentricity, and notoriety had haunted the Albright family for probably 100 years, until a couple of very high-profile suicides and an unsolved murder or three a decade or so ago had brought the notoriety to a climax that ended up with everyone in the family dead, except for Richard Albright. As I recalled, he'd been in his early 20s at the time, and his wife's had been one of the unsolved murders.
That's the one, she said.
He moved to Canada right after the trial, Zack said.
When I looked at him, he raised both hands slightly and said,
It was all over the tabloids. No one who ever walked into a grocery store didn't know about the murder trial and everything.
Lisa nodded soberly.
And after a few years, he moved very quietly to Prosser.
I blinked at her. No one rich and famous moved to Prosser. It was a small town about 30 miles west of the Tri-Cities. It wasn't a pretty people place like Walla Walla, which was pressed up against the Blue Mountains and beautifully green. Lisa had missed my surprise and continued to impart information in a circuitous fashion.
"He never leaves the grounds, not ever," she looked at me. "And 3 days ago, I found out why not."
I could feel the headache come on. She didn't want me to fix his wagon. "Ghosts," I said, wondering who she'd been talking to.
"His dead wife," she said at the same time.
"I don't hunt ghosts," I told her. The only time I'd tried had ended up with bodies. Her mouth firmed.
"I called in some big favors to get your name."
"Who talked to you?" I asked. The wolves knew that I could see ghosts, I was pretty sure, though I didn't make a big deal of it. That left.
"My best friend's husband is Wenatchee and Cree. He's a historian and folklorist, so I called her and he called me back this morning with your name. He said you are a walker and a spirit speaker and that you could help me. He said to tell you that Hank Redtail owes him a favor and he is calling it in."
Hank's last name on his driver's license wasn't Redtail, but just as I turned into a coyote, he turned into a red-tail hawk. For some of the traditionalists, a person's name had more to do with who they were than what their birth certificate said. I pulled out my phone to call Hank, but saw that sometime in the last 4 hours, he'd sent a text message. "Ghost strong as this is bad news. Listen to the story." I ground my teeth, took a deep breath, and said, "Hank tells me I need to hear you." Lisa's story. Richard Albright's place used to be a horse farm. Most of the stables stood empty, if well kept and pretty, but the small two-stall stud barn was Lisa's for equipment storage or anything else. It had an empty office with a working mini-fridge stocked with bottled water and a bathroom. Since his place was 10 miles from anywhere, the bathroom was useful. For a week in the spring and another in the fall, she'd bring a whole crew in to work the flower beds, clean out fountains, and do general repair. But because of the need for secrecy, Lisa did Albright's place by herself twice a week the rest of the year. Sometimes Richard Albright came out and joined her. The first time he'd done it, he'd introduced himself as Rick and told her she was supposed to find things for him to do. So she'd done as he asked. He hadn't known anything about plants or landscaping or even mowing when he started. It took her 6 months to figure out that Rick, who came out a couple of times a month to work with her, was Richard Albright, multi-bazillionaire, who was the most notorious escapee from justice because he was rich on the planet. She'd thought about it for maybe 5 seconds and decided to keep on treating him the same way she always had. They grew to be friends. About 4 years in, she realized the reason that the last 4 men she dated had been so boring was because she was comparing them to the funny, smart-mouthed guy who trimmed blackberry bushes with her. She wasn't an idiot. There was no way someone like him was going to be interested in his groundskeeper. She didn't mind. It just hadn't seemed worthwhile to keep dating once she knew. So she stopped. It had been tough not saying anything, but Lisa was tough-minded, and it was easier to have an unrequited love than to get all fussed and dressed and go out on dates every Saturday with men she was never going to fall in love with. So she'd quit dating, quit dressing up, and on the whole, she was happier than she'd been before. "I thought this was about a ghost," I said. "Much as I am willing to listen to your painful romance story, there isn't much I can do for you in that area." Lisa blinked at me. "Right," she said. "Sorry." Zack put his hand on hers where it rested on her car door. She gave him a tremulous smile and started her story again. 2 days ago, Lisa had mowed half the lawn, gone through 2 water bottles, and set out for the bathroom in the stud barn. The matter was of some urgency, so she was dismayed to see an out-of-order sign on it. Taped to the bottom of the sign was a sheet of lined paper. "Lisa," it read. "Sorry, well woes, apparently. should be okay by next week. If you need to use the facilities, come on up to the house. Rick. Had it not been urgent, she'd have just packed up and gone into town. As it was, she headed up to the main house and rang the doorbell. She'd planted the azaleas on either side of the door where they'd be sheltered from the cold and wind. She'd grown the hanging baskets and hung them herself. And she'd never been inside the house, not in 8 years.
"Hey," Rick said, answering the door.
His hair was ruffled, as if he'd been dragging his fingers through it. His shirt had a hole in it, just left of his navel. In short, he looked like he did most of the time he was out working with her. But his bare feet were on marble tiles, and the ceiling was 10 feet or more over his head. Hanging on the entry wall behind him was an oil by a Western artist who died 100 years ago, and was well enough known that even Lisa, who had no interest in art of any kind unless it was green and growing, had heard of him. And suddenly, it wasn't her buddy Rick who was standing there, but a bazillionaire who she was bothering, and she couldn't open her mouth and make noise come out. He looked at her, and instead of looking haughty, as she'd half expected, his mouth curved up.
"Bathroom," he said, stepping back. "Come on in, Lisa. Down the hall, first left, past the hot tub room, and through the next set of doors. Or you could take the third left, fourth right, or up the stairs, and since there are more bathrooms than bedrooms, I expect you could find one."
"Sorry," she mumbled.
"Not a problem. It's just me here. I only need one bathroom at a time."
But she'd already passed him and headed for the first bathroom he told her about. She'd been mute. She'd mumbled. And the third thing she tended to do when she was uncomfortable was babble. Given that she really had to pee right now, she really, really didn't want to babble about that to the man she loved from afar. When she turned to the left, there was a floor-to-ceiling glass wall on her left with a sliding glass door. On the other side of all that glass was a room filled with ferns and a huge hot tub. The cover was a deep brown that contrasted with the bright green ferns and the pale off-white of the tile on the wall and matched the dark brown marble tile on the floor. Daylight for the ferns drifted down from a pair of skylights and illuminated a statue of Pan in the corner. The sly old faun was raising his pipes to his wickedly sensuous mouth, and he gifted the rest of the room with a distinctly Grecian look. She waved a hand at the statue because it seemed polite, and hit the bathroom with a sigh of honest relief that not even the imposing acres of marble and wood and things expensive that were all over the room could detract from. She finished up quickly, washed and dried her hands, and opened the door. She turned her head to say goodbye to Pan, and screamed. "I'm kind of embarrassed about that," she told me. "And I'd rather not have to confess to screaming like a B-movie queen, but..." She shrugged. She'd only been in the bathroom a couple of minutes, and in that time someone had taken off the cover to the hot tub and dribbled body parts all over the hot tub room. A leg, clean sliced like someone had put it through a bandsaw, lay on the floor in front of the statue of Pan. Another leg was positioned so the cut end was hidden by the hot tub stair. The woman's legless and armless torso was arched over the edge of the hot tub where the hot water bubbled red as blood, red with blood. The woman's head was balanced on the edge of the tub closest to Lisa. When Lisa screamed, the eyes opened, and the detached head said, "It's his fault." Lisa later remembered hearing the words as clearly as though someone had whispered in her ear, though the glass blocked the sound of the bubbling water, and a detached head couldn't speak, no air. And that impossibility finally cued Lisa in that what she saw wasn't real. A moment later, an arm wrapped itself around her and tugged her away from the hot tub and out the front door. Rick sat her down on the top step on the porch and forced her head between her knees. When she could focus on what he was saying, she heard,
"Tell me, damn it, you saw that. You did. You saw."
She blinked a couple of times and pushed against his hands. He let her sit up. "What the freak was that?" she asked him. "Rick, do you have aspirations of being the next George Lucas or David Cronenberg or something? I've got to tell you, it really had me going until the head started talking." He sat down beside her and looked up at the sky and gave a funny half laugh.
"You saw that.
The body in the hot tub room? Yes, of course I saw it. It was brilliant. She reconsidered. Sadistic and horrible, but brilliant. He rubbed his face, then rubbed his hair and laughed again.
I thought I was crazy, he whispered. 14 years. No one ever sees it.
Lisa just stared at him.
It won't be there now, he told her. You can go look, but she never stays for long.
She?
My wife, he told her, and he put his head in his hands. She's dead. She's dead and she won't leave me alone. No one sees her. No one ever sees her but me.
You mean, said Lisa, suddenly understanding what had happened, you mean that was a ghost? She blinked at him. You see that all the time?
My half-brother Gary answered the phone on the fifth ring.
Wait just a minute, he said, sounding a little breathless.
I waited, listening to a few grunts and my brother's croons. I had an unsettled thought that there was a woman involved in this wait, just as he came back on the phone, though it wasn't quite the right grunts.
Sorry, he said. I'm training horses. Right now I'm on a 2-year-old who objected to my cell phones ringing.
My brother had left the state of Washington with prejudice. He'd found a job at a horse ranch in Montana where they raised quarter horses, a few Appaloosas, and cattle. Isn't two a little young? I asked. I didn't know a lot about horses, but I'd grown up around people who did.
Yep, he agreed. This one will be 3 next week, but still young. Driven by the market, Mercy. There isn't a lot of profit in breeding horses anymore, and the ranch has no choice but to listen to market forces if they want to survive. It's not like we take them out for 50-mile trips.
Then, presumably to the horse,
you can just settle your butt down, sweetheart. Get used to it now, my friend. Life for you is going to be all about hurry up and wait.
I need to know how to exorcise a ghost, I said to Gary. Lisa abruptly looked a lot less confident in me. I hadn't told her why I was calling Gary. I held up one finger when it looked like she was going to speak. My brother has good ears. He didn't need to get distracted by a pretty voice.
You just tell them to move on, he said.
Just tell them? I was doubtful, and I let him hear it. When I was a kid, I'd screamed, go away, at a lot of ghosts, to not much effect.
Tell them, he said with exaggerated patience, the way your alpha werewolf husband would tell one of his wolves when they get pushy.
Okay, I said. I almost thanked him and hung up, but there was something in his voice. He was a son of Coyote, as much as he hated it, and that made him a little tricksy.
Where do they go?
He laughed, and I knew I'd been right.
Somewhere else, usually not too far away. One of our distant nephews back in the Victorian age had a grand con. He found a haunted house and drove the ghost, a nasty moaning type, out. They paid him for it, then he waited a week and went to the house next door and did the same. If he'd stopped at the fifth house, he'd have made a tidy profit. But he'd forgotten that neighbors talked to each other. He knocked on the door of the sixth, and the man of the house tried to hold him for the authorities. Sadly for both of them, the young entrepreneur was killed in the struggle.
I waited, but he wasn't going to continue until I asked, why for both of them?
Because when our budding con artist nephew died, the man in the sixth house was left with a very nasty ghost that no one could send on. I hear that it is still there today.
Why couldn't someone else send it on? I asked.
Didn't they teach you anything? Gary exclaimed. Then in a softer voice he said, no, I suppose not. The werewolves wouldn't know, and our dear papa couldn't be bothered. A ghost, my dear sister, gains power when it is seen. When it is recognized by one of our kind, it gains a firmer hold on the world. There is a reason you shouldn't speak the name of the dead.
I see, I said. So how do I get rid of a ghost permanently?
He sighed. You don't read ghost stories either, do you?
You have to find out why it is lingering.
Confront it and take away its reason for being there. That only works with the ones who are intelligent, though. Convincing them that they really are dead is also supposed to be useful. Most ghosts usually fade away given time. Why are you asking me about ghosts?
Because someone came to me for help. And I explained the situation to him in a somewhat more condensed version. There was a little pause.
Well, Good luck with that, then, he said doubtfully. Call me if you get into trouble. Not that I can help you, but maybe I can learn something to pass on to the next walker who calls to ask me for help.
I think he was teasing, but I wasn't sure enough to call him on it.
Will do, I said instead. It has always been an ambition of mine to serve as an object lesson for others.
Nice to have ambitions, he said. A ghost that has been following a person around for 14 years, that's not normal.
I do know that, I told him.
Might not be a ghost at all, he said as if thinking aloud. A witch could do something similar.
I thought about that, I told him. The gruesome talking head was very Hollywood, I thought. Not something I'd ever seen a ghost do. Not that it wasn't possible, just that I'd never seen it.
Take backup, he told me.
I love you too, I told him and hung up. As soon as I was off the phone, Lisa asked, You don't know how to exorcise a ghost? I shrugged. I've never tried it. Most ghosts are harmless, or nearly so. My brother has more experience with that kind of thing. Like several hundred years more experience. I thought it was worth a shot.
Maybe he could exorcise Rick's ghost?
I shook my head regretfully. He lives 300 miles away and his job doesn't let him travel. Not to Washington, anyway. Not until they quit looking for him as an escaped prisoner.
Maybe I should look for someone else with more experience, she said.
Okay, I agreed.
Okay?
I'm not a ghost hunter, I told her. You could probably do an internet search and find a group nearby. If they don't know how to get rid of a ghost, maybe they'll know someone who does.
Think of the publicity, murmured Zack. Ghost hunters investigate famous recluse's house.
I stepped on his toe. I feel some obligation to help when people ask me for it. I'm not sure why, but only a little obligation in this case because I didn't know either of the people involved. If she thought someone else would be better, I wasn't going to argue with her, especially since she was probably right.
Do you mind coming out and taking a look? She said. I think Rick has probably had enough publicity for a lifetime. If you can't do anything, maybe we'll try someone else.
I looked at my garage. It doesn't appear as though I have anything better to do. I called Adam to let him know what we were doing, but his phone bumped me to another one.
Home and security, said one of Adam's minions.
This is Mercy, I said.
He cleared his throat. Okay. I have a message for you if you called. Here it is. Duty calls. Someone broke into a warehouse we have under contract. Cops came, but it looks like burglar has a hostage. They need someone familiar with the layout, so I'm headed out. Call you when it's over. Not dangerous.
I waited, but apparently that was it.
Okay, I said. Tell Adam I've gone ghost hunting. I'm taking Zack, and we'll be back tonight. Not dangerous.
I hesitated.
Okay, probably not dangerous, but he knows how these things go with me.
Address? Boss will want an address.
I looked at Lisa. Where are we going? Her lips thinned.
My husband runs a security firm. They can keep secrets.
Your husband, the werewolf?
That's the one.
She gave me the address. I told Adam's man what it was, and we all headed out. Lisa in her Tahoe, and Zack and I in my Vanagon. Prosser, like the Tri-Cities, is in a region of wine country that started out as orchard country. We took the highway on the north side of the Yakima River instead of the interstate on the south, and it weaved along the river's path through hobby farms and ranches that increased for a minute in density to become the town of Whitstrand before thinning out again into countryside. Zack didn't talk as we drove. He turned his baseball cap around and covered his eyes. Someone else might have thought he was sleeping, but I could smell his alertness. He was just conserving his strength. I couldn't tell what he thought about going ghost hunting with me beyond that. The whole drive between my garage in East Kennewick to Prosser is usually about 45 minutes on the interstate. The old Inland Empire Highway was twistier and slower, so we'd been driving about an hour when Lisa turned toward the river. The road was one of those sneaky dirt roads hidden in the narrow gap between fences. The highway had turned away from the river, and we drove maybe a quarter of a mile when the dirt road dropped and twisted, revealing a hidden Garden of Eden tucked into a flattish 15 or 20 acre parcel between the river and a bench of basalt.
On the side of the road was a tall signpost with a large mailbox beside it. The top and biggest sign said, The Hollow. Below it, on smaller hand-painted signs, were No Hunting, No Trespassing, Go Away, and Yes, This Means You. We passed a barn, a smaller stable, then wound around to stop in front of a house that was maybe twice the size of the one I lived in with Adam. Since Adam's house had been built with the idea that it would serve as a meeting house and safe house for Adam's werewolf pack, our house was huge. We parked in front of the house and followed Lisa to the door. She gave me a nervous glance. "I didn't tell him I was bringing you," she said. "A little late to mention it now," I told her. "Are we going to stand on the porch until he notices us, or are you going to ring the bell?" She hit the bell, and I could hear it echo. Rick must have had it piped in several places throughout the house. We waited long enough that Lisa was getting nervous before Rick Albright opened the door. He was not as impressive as I had expected. The werewolves have given me a skewed view on the world. Important werewolves drip authority and, usually, dignity. Dignity, at least, wasn't apparently important to Richard Albright. It would have helped if his glasses had not been held together with green duct tape. It would have helped if his shirt hadn't had a hole in the shoulder. Helped more if there weren't little toy boats sailing across it. But I don't think I would have liked him as quickly if it hadn't been for the toy boats. The only person I'd ever had that instant like for was Anna Cornick, the only Omega werewolf I've ever met. However, Rick stepped out on the porch, shut the door behind him, folded his arms, and narrowed his eyes. Despite being the shortest person on the porch, he had enough authority to make Zack drop his gaze and step back.
"Lisa?" Rick's voice was soft and hostile. "To what do I owe the pleasure?"
I expected somehow for her to drop back to babbling as she had with me. Instead, she said with a bit of defiance, "That thing has been following you around for more than a decade, so I made some calls, and they sent me to Mercy Hauptmann here." He looked at her, and the connection between them was bright and clear to my coyote nose. She might not have told him that she wanted him. And from what she'd told me, he'd never told her he wanted her either, but I could have cut the sexual tension in that exchange of looks with a knife. Zack tucked his head and covered his smile with a hand. Rick's eyes focused on me, and all that heat turned to ice.
"I have no intention of paying you anything."
"You have a VW around here that needs work?" I asked casually, glancing around. The only cars I could see were ours. He frowned, and the intensity of his gaze picked up.
"No."
"That's the only thing I charge for," I told him. "I'm a mechanic by trade. This ghost thing is not my chosen profession, and before you invite me in, you ought to know that the last time someone talked me into checking out a ghost, it turned out to be something a lot more dangerous. The woman who invited me to her house ended up dead." He pushed his glasses up his nose.
"How did she die? Did the ghost kill her? Did you?"
"No, and no, but I couldn't save her either," I told him. He asked Lisa,
"Who sent you to her?"
"Kiri's husband."
He took a breath, nodded abruptly, and opened the door to his house.
"I suppose you'd better come inside, then."
A curious thing happened as we entered the house. I shot a quick glance at Zack, who frowned at me and tilted his head. He'd smelled it, too. Emotions have a scent. More of a feel, I guess. A combination of the sound of breath, heartbeat, and body secretions. Nervous sweat, aroused sweat, and exercise sweat are composed of different substances. They have an intensity, too. Outside on the porch, Rick had been aroused by Lisa and angry at our intrusion and a variety of other things. He'd been intense. As soon as we came inside the house, everything muted. It might have been some effect of being safely in his own home. The force of emotions quite often is ameliorated by a safe haven. But this was a much stronger drop than I'd ever seen before. And Lisa's emotions did exactly the same thing as soon as she stepped across the threshold. The effect was momentary, like what sound does just before your ears repressurize after an airplane flight or driving down out of the mountains. We followed Rick, and by the time he'd led us across the entrance hall into a room that felt mostly unused, his emotions and Lisa's were normal. If Zack hadn't noticed it too, I'd have thought I had imagined it. The room was empty of smells. No one spent enough time here to leave a mark. Couches placed just so were without the normal scuffs and worn edges that such things acquire in daily living. Rick gestured us forward, but he himself stopped at a discreet half bar.
"Can I get you anything?" he asked, opening a sliding cabinet door I could hear even though I couldn't see it.
He pulled four glasses out and set them down.
"Not me," said Zack.
"No."
Lisa had walked across the room to look out the window at the river.
"No, thank you."
The lack of other scents made some things very interesting. I stepped closer to Rick and took a deep breath. "Are you Faye?" His hand stilled where he had half lifted a bottle of soda water over a glass.
"My grandfather," he told me. "My mother's father. He abandoned his wife and my mother. I don't know exactly what he was. He left me with a bit of intuition about people, and that's it."
He finished pouring.
"I tell you this because you're married to a werewolf. I may be isolated, but I do read local newspapers. Hauptmann is a name that comes up as often as the reporters can figure out how to slide it in. The Tri-City's most famous person. The handsome face of werewolves everywhere."
I smiled at his sarcasm. "I think he's pretty, too. Truthfully, his good looks annoy him, though he's not above using them when he needs to."
"I will answer your questions mostly because my fae-born intuition," he smiled wryly, "for what it is worth, tells me that you are exactly what you say you are, and that you just might be able to help. I am not in the habit of sharing my family secrets with everyone."
He grimaced.
"If you really wanted to know, you could just read any of the true crime novels written about my wife's murder anyway."
"All right." I felt bad intruding on his privacy, even if it might be for his own good. I met his eyes. "You should know that I'm not Fae or werewolf, but I am something. That's how I knew you were Fae, and that's why I might be able to do something about your ghost. I'm giving you my secret because I stole one from you. And I'll be asking you for more. You should have at least one of mine in return." Rick looked at me, then nodded. He glanced at Zack.
"Our introductions were truncated. I'm Rick Albright. Lisa, you've obviously met, and I've met Ms. Hauptmann."
"Zack Drummond,"
Zack introduced himself. Rick nodded.
"All right."
He looked at me.
"You're in charge."
"Lisa said your wife has been haunting you since her death," I told him. He nodded.
"I thought ghosts were supposed to be attached to the place they died, or at least someplace important to them, but it doesn't matter where I am, in airports, business meetings."
He blanched, drank the soda water in one smooth gulp.
"Sometimes she looks alive. I'll look over and she's eating at the table next to me."
He looked away from us and kept talking more and more quietly, as if noise would make the images more real,
or walking down the road. "Sometimes she's in pieces, just like when I came in from a night of drinking and found her body cut up in our kitchen. Some of her was in the sink. Some of her was..."
He stopped speaking.
"Excuse me," he said, and walked rapidly out of the room.
Zack and I could hear him vomiting. We waited for him. Lisa, visibly torn, because she wanted to follow him.
"Sorry," he apologized as he returned.
"Why don't you show us around the house," I said. "Tell me if you see her, and I'll tell you if..." And standing behind him was a woman who was almost 6 feet tall, a stunning redhead with bright blue eyes and a sad mouth. She reached out and ran a hand over his shoulder. "Well," I said, "I don't think that will be necessary. What was your wife's name?"
"Nicole."
He stared at me, then looked behind him.
"You see her? She's not there."
"She's wearing a camisole," I said, "blue, with embroidered black flowers, and a pair of black yoga pants."
"That's what she was wearing when she was killed," he said. "All the newspapers reported it."
His eyes narrowed at me in sudden suspicion. He turned all the way around, looking through the ghost I saw as if she weren't there.